Our first reading is by Mevlana Rumi, and it is Quietness. This poet is a Sufi mystic, and he's talking about what we could call the death of ego. And it's likened to an immersion in the holy, immersion in God consciousness. Think of freedom and silence.
Inside this new love, die. Your way begins on the other side. Become the sky. Take an axe to the prison wall. Escape. Walk out like someone suddenly born into color. Do it now. You're covered with thick cloud. Slide out the side. Die and be quiet. Quietness is the surest sign that you've died. Your old life was a frantic running from silence. The speechless full moon comes out now.
Second reading is from Audre Lorde and from the book Sister Outsider. Lorde was a black political activist. She wrote on race and racism, classism, sexual identity, gender issues, power relations, and society. And this reading was originally delivered in Chicago, 1977. In the transformation of silence into language and action, it is vitally necessary for each one of us to establish or examine her function in that transformation and to recognize her voice, her role as vital within that transformation. It is necessary to teach by living and speaking those trusts which we believe and know beyond understanding, because in this way alone can we survive. By taking part in a process of life that is creative and continuing, that is growth. And it is never without fear. For that visibility which makes us most vulnerable is also the source of our greatest strength. Because the machine will try to grind you into dust anyway, whether or not we speak. We can sit in our corners, mute forever, while our children are distorted and destroyed, while our earth is poisoned. We can sit in our safe corners, mute as bottles, and we will still be no less afraid. Several years ago, my family and I, we were fortunate enough to be guests to an interfaith dialogue trip to Turkey. And Turkey is the birthplace of my father, and when I was a child, I had the opportunity to visit several times. But this was a tremendous opportunity in that I could share my heritage, revisit my heritage, and also as a clergy person, learn hands-on, experientially, something that was important to me, dialogue and talk across borders. One of my favorite snapshot memories I'll share with you, we were walking through Konya, which is a more conservative town, city of Rumi, and a blonde American, maybe 10 years my senior, myself, and our Turkish host, woman that we were with in a veil. We walked down the streets, engaged in conversation, laughing and affectionate with each other with no pretense, and it just seemed like a snapshot of good relationships across culture, across faith, and friendship. We had memories like this every day, but there's one memory that kind of haunts me, and I'm going to share that one with you too. On one leg of our trip, we were taken to more of the rural area, and we had to we went to Espendos to look at ruins. And on the day back to the big cities, we stopped. We had to go by way of a busy rural airport. Our host expected that we would be missing our plane, and so they divided. One went to get the tickets, and the others tried to herd our small group toward the holding area, which was pretty much packed wall to wall. As they tried to herd us through, explaining that these are Americans, they're our guests, and they will be late, and we want to show hospitality, the people didn't really appreciate this explanation. And I really had no desire to be there another 3 days either. So they herded us through. We ended up going through the closed doors just before they shut, and we stayed in there with angry looks and voices, even shouting after us. It was extremely awkward, and it was uncomfortable. Their anger was real. And we were literally placed ahead of the other people. And I share this with you. It's rather unflattering, but I share it to illustrate several points. And I hold it up as a mirror. There are some tangled emotions that surface, and I'm confronted with what I say I believe and how I actually chose to behave in that circumstance. The option was placed before me, and I took advantage of privilege. I would prefer not to feel awkward or guilt or shame. I'd prefer to dismiss them, perhaps, and maybe I did. Well, what could we do? Our hosts are in charge, and we don't speak the language. This sequence of encountering things we don't like in ourselves or missing the mark is pretty normal and typical of the first stage of encountering privilege. And I bring it up because it's a place of anguish, and it's often a place of stopping, a stopping point for the most well-intentioned people. So how do we use anguish as part of a river flowing towards justice versus a quagmire or a stuck place? And what's so bad about just avoiding the discomfort? Avoidance maintains the status quo, and it's the socially underprivileged who bear the cost of a system of advantage. Avoiding discomfort lessens my awareness and cuts me off from deeper engagement with people, which was the whole reason of being there, yes? The Gibran quote at the top of our order of service may be of some comfort. Pain is the breaking of the shell that imprisons our understanding. Rumi, too, reminds us that awareness is a spiritual practice, and I want to trust that on the other side of the prison of my conventions and biases that there is freedom, freedom found in living in relationships that are fair and humane. And part of this freedom comes when I stop defending myself and shift to harnessing the power that awareness brings. As we gain awareness to what is at first invisible to us, institutionalized or embedded forms of racism or privilege, we can use our power as individuals and as people, communities, to resist as the poet Lord cautions, the part of our culture that grinds lives into dust. Now, laws and privileges are commonplace, and they're necessary for the well-being of a society. For instance, if I graduate from an accredited nursing school, pass my boards, and am licensed, I have the privilege of practicing nursing. It's necessary for society. White skin privilege is a term given to what began as a politically and socially constructed system of attitudes, laws, and practices that set some people in front of others. It started in rural colonial America. The poor were unified in protest against the governor of the Virginia colony in the Bacon Rebellions of 1676. And the union, the unity of these people, was a threat. This rebellion is often cited as the beginning of systemized legislation to create a buffer class, to separate the lower class, create a buffer between the wealth and power and the poor. Because this system has been perpetuated and it's based on skin pigmentation, it's a system based on unearned privilege. Privileges that many are invisible to light-skinned people like myself who have enjoyed privilege my entire life. One of the hardest things about getting it is that it's largely unspoken. Peggy McIntosh likens white privilege to carrying an invisible knapsack that includes all kinds of privileges. Freedom to associate wherever you want. Relative freedom to buy a home wherever I want. I can go to a bank and my financial reliability may be unquestioned. It's unlikely that I will have to show papers in Arizona. Driving while white means that I don't have to worry about being detained, harassed, or endangered just because of my skin color. I can go shopping without having someone follow me. I can even go back several days later and say, I forgot to pick up a couple things. I'll just go get them now. Oh, sure, go ahead. One of the things that we need to do, I need to do, when I'm trying to engage a little bit further than my discomfort is look at my history, my identity formation. And I'll cite a couple examples of why I resist the term privilege, because I do for several reasons. I became more acutely aware of differences in people's backgrounds as a child in school. There are some that are not as smart as others. Some were treated with disrespect, wearing shabby clothes. In contrast, I was treated with respect and care. Part of that was because I was well-behaved, yes, and part of it was probably my father's standing in the community. Class makes a difference. Yet, I also knew that my parents came from families with limited resources. Both had stories to tell of hardship and poverty. Both worked hard. Somewhat sacred story to me is hearing of my mother leaving home at 17, running away from home, and being taken in by folks who, she says with such gratefulness, they gave me a chance when I had nothing. They gave me a chance when no one thought I was worth anything. And my father came here as becoming a citizen, worked hard. I'm proud of their contributions to the community. But this also sets up an assumption that hard work and being a good person allows success, where that's not always the case. Those aren't always opportunities open to people. I identify as white, although I admit that every once in a while I get feedback that it's not so obvious to other people. For example, once I was talking with a delightful African-American woman at the hospital, and she asked me if sometimes, like her, do sometimes people mistake you for being white? She was commenting on my beautiful hair, she said. And I was endeared to her. Because sometimes this will get me in places where maybe normally I couldn't go. Also, I'm legally married to my partner. I enjoy basic human rights that are denied to those who are gay, lesbian, transgendered. I'm not really at risk of harm or even murder because of my sexual orientation, although being a woman adds its own set of risks and disadvantages. I'm able-bodied with above average intelligence, despite what my children may tell you. I'm of sound enough mind, despite what my husband may joke. And I have a good sense of humor, despite evidence this morning. So, as a white straight woman, I take part in a hierarchical system where, through unfair cultural and political leveraging, I am placed unfairly ahead of some and unfairly behind others. Deconstructing the system, the myth of success based on merit is exposed. It doesn't negate my hard work, but rather shows there's a hidden cost and a hidden burden to privilege. Along with members of the Racial Diversity Task Force, I'm reading The Arc of the Universe is Long, and this book chronicles the history of anti-racist work in our denomination. This excerpt is from Reverend Sean Dennison. When people ask me, what's it like to have a black child? I tell them this story. Before I had my son, racism was like a monster out there on the edges of my world. I disliked it. I was completely and totally against racism. It was in my mind an ugly, hideous monster. Then I woke up one day, and my baby was in the monster's teeth. So anti-racism and anti-oppression work is no longer an abstraction for me. I live with the monster. I also live with the gift of having my world open to culture, experience, and strengths I never knew existed. It's the hardest and it's the best thing I've ever done. While I have not perhaps crossed the race line, I have been able to look and love across it and begin to learn how to break down the crazy concepts that go with race boxes that we've lived with so long. So Sean gives us a powerful image. The monster of racism has his beloved baby in his arms, in his teeth. Like Audre Lorde, Dennison knows that the beast is relentless in its power to destroy. Yet he says it's the hardest and the best thing he's ever done. Perhaps at times an experience of freedom. Lorde tells us it's necessary to teach by living and speaking the trust we believe and know beyond understanding. Many years ago, when I was working as a nurse at Children's, I was giving homegoing instructions to the parents of a child whose baby was critically ill a week before with meningitis and now was bouncing around ready to go home. And they said to me, how do you do this work? My answer left me feeling strangely vulnerable, as if I had uncovered a life truth, because it came from a place of quiet honesty. It's a privilege to take care of your children and the children here. We do it during some very tenuous times. I know that when a parent leaves to catch a few hours of sleep, they're trusting us with their beloved child. Okay, the words aren't profound, but the feeling was. Perhaps Audre Lorde would articulate what I could not, perhaps saying that I was invested in protecting the process of life and caring for the generations, I could imagine. But I discovered and disclosed a personal and heartfelt aspect of myself, a touchstone, a part that I was more comfortable leaving unspoken. To take up the responsibility to care for others and nurture the well-being of life outside the circle of my concern. Or perhaps it was the expansiveness of realizing that others came within my circle. It left me with a feeling of joy and grounding. What I'm trying to say is at that time in my life, I was focused on getting the next certification, the next checklist to prove myself as competent. And the feeling of groundedness came from a place of silence and discovery. And Rumi speaks to me again. Your struggle to be someone running away frantically or running away from your own silence. He dares us to live from that silence. Years later, I watched my 2-year-old sleeping and was filled with an overwhelming gratitude for the privilege of being his mother, entrusted with his precious life. Lost in my motherly reverie, my thoughts drifted, and I imagined him at the end of his life. Who would care for him? Would he be alone? What if he cried out and no one heard him? This sequence of thought brought me to grief. And that night, as my love expanded again, I held the lonely, the old, those at the end of their lives, along with my beloved son, close to my heart, and I just sobbed. I prayed that someone would be there for them. I thank God for those who love the old and those who were there with the dying and lonely at the end of their lives. And when the feeling subsided, my intellect chimed in. No wonder we, collective humanity, so often have a parent image of God. And touchstone. Years later, as a chaplain, I was singing to a man at the end of his life, and these memories surfaced with the realization that I had lived into a prayer. I too love the elderly, the lonely, and those at the end of their lives. I hold these experiences as clues to what Lord calls sacred trust, and I see it akin to the anguish that Sean Dennison feels when his baby is caught in the teeth of the beast. The nature of the beast, racism and all oppressions, is to distort and destroy. Lord is talking about our broken relationships with each other. Every form of oppression is a break in the sacred trust, the kinship between us. In our blindness and in our apathy, we forsake accountability to each other. We close off our hearts, and thus the distortion is not only to the injured, but to ourselves. We numb ourselves by turning away from the suffering, and in denying our part in it, we thus deny ourselves the healing that comes from working for justice in our world. Deepening my awareness of my own unearned privilege and the benefits that I enjoy from my light skin has been work that's humbling. It's sometimes humiliating and often painful. It confronts me with the unfairness that undergirds our society, my participation in this society. Awareness, yes, brings pain. and difficult emotions. But the task is not to stop here. Because even the best intentions and the best intended are tempted to disengage and check out. Armor can go up to protect. Arms go up in helplessness. We turn away. We don't see the marginalized. People become invisible. We Unitarian Universalists share a rich, diverse, mixed spiritual heritage. As inheritors of our Jewish and Christian tradition, covenant and relationships with each other are central to how we make our way in the world. We aspire to see the divine within each member of the human family. As children of the Enlightenment and Greek philosophical tradition, we celebrate truth and reason. As members of the Protestant tradition, we hold the legacy of protest and resistance, which has always been an important part of our identity. Oppression. It's a deep break in the sacred trust that binds generation to generation. By recognizing that we participate and we are injured by this, we can work to resist the damage and promote much needed healing. May it be so.